Abby.
And I'm Allie.
And it's About Time for True Crime. Hi. Hello.
Hello, you guys.
How are you guys doing?
How's your Tuesday or any other day of the week?
I know. We are having, it's only the beginning of the week, but we're having a hell of a week over here.
It's a hell of a week.
Yeah, it's been a year of a week, if I'm being honest.
Truly.
But we hope that you guys are having a good time. Currently, I am personally suffering from what is known as brain scramblies, scientifically, and also a hurdy tummy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Abby has been diagnosed with brain scramblies, as I have also recently been.
It's catching. You might not want to listen.
Diagnosed.
You should listen.
It is contagious.
Yeah.
But it does kind of make you a little silly, goofy, fun, which does. Is great. But Abby has the case of the tummy hurts.
Yeah. God gives his hurtiest tummies to his hottest girlies. And I stand by that.
To his strongest soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And Abby has been fighting tooth and nail to eat gluten like you wouldn't imagine.
And that's for you. I'm doing that for you, listener. Like, if I didn't eat gluten, what terrible kind of version of myself would I be? Even though I shouldn't, and it hurts me every time.
She is physically and metaphorically falling on her sword.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right in the stomach.
Yeah, it's so true.
And we're all better for it. She pays the price, but we get the benefit.
It's not easy being a martyr for the things that are important. I'm sorry. See, brain scramblies. This is the kind of day we're having.
We're a little silly goofy here on this day.
Mm-hmm.
Neither of us have slept well.
Nope.
We are running on E, but you know what? Cases still need to be told.
Cases need to be told.
We still need to hang out with our ATFTC family.
You guys haven't heard us ask for a pod pet in a week, at least. Like, what are you going to do if we're not here for you in this trying time?
I know. It's as if your day could mostly be the same, except
a little bit different.
Except just slightly different.
And you might not catch the brain scramblies, but that's a risk we're going to have to take. Okay.
It's true. So strap in.
Strap in.
Hands, arms, feet, and legs inside the podcast at all times.
Zoom in. Yoo-hoo. Pods on. Okay?
Yoo-hoo. It's a you and a who to you, okay?
Thank you. Please. Yoo-hoo was my mother. Hello. Welcome or welcome back to your favorite true crime podcast. About time for true crime.
You guys.
That's us. I'm back with you today, coming at you with a brand new case and a two-parter at that.
Ooh.
Who is she?
I love her.
She has tummy issues. She just moved. She's not a teenager anymore, according to the man who looked at her back at urgent care. But I'm here for you with two parts.
Do you guys remember when Abby pulled something in her back? And homegirl could not walk. She could not move. She stumbled her ass into my house.
Uh-huh.
She did not go far. And she went to urgent care and they said, well, what do you expect? You're not 16 anymore.
Yeah, the guy was like, I have a baby at home. I know lower back pain. Go home.
And you're like, yeah, but I'm not 65 either. What the fuck?
But anyway, that's how brave I am. I'm coming to you through all that right now.
I hope you guys know we're so fucking kidding.
We're so kidding. And also, I will be honest, I am feeling a little bit brave right now. There's a hint of honesty in that part.
She is fighting back tummy aches.
Because today we have to talk about a pretty heinous guy. Well, that's kind of debatable. It really depends on how you look at the person.
Okay.
I mean, he did horrible things, and I am by no means saying he was a good person. But I think that, at least from my time in the field, I've seen people who commit crimes with a similar, not MO, not intensity, but motive.
Mm-hmm.
Motive being for your family, to keep the people that you love protected and safe and well in as many places as they can.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think he was a pretty heinous guy, but he was also a family guy. And if you clicked on it, you know that today we're talking about Charles Sinclair. And if you, much like me, much like Allie, are thinking, whomst? He is what is nicknamed the coin shop killer. He's a serial killer I had never heard of before a week ago.
Yeah, this is news to me.
Uh-huh. This case is from the 80s, so it's not incredibly well documented online. I had to look at some sources from like archived New York Times, but I was able to use some sources that were really good. And I wanted to give a huge shout out to Evil Lives Here.
Taking a page out of my book.
I sure did. And I also wanted to give a really, really big shout out to Northern Nightmares, which was a podcast that I used. It's an Alaskan-based true crime podcast. And they helped so significantly with dates. So, like I said, this doesn't have a ton of coverage on it. The interview in Evil Lives Here is from Charles' daughter. And so for her, she's sort of recounting what it's like not knowing that all of this was going on. So it's been kind of a search for a needle in a haystack to find any more specifics than what are like the things that pop up in the first article that you read.
Right. And I find with Evil Lives Here, there's like a lot of shows, I think some of it's like embellished and really done for like dramatic effect and, yeah, you know, all of these things. But what I can appreciate about that show is that there's really not like dramatic retellings as much as they are people sitting for interviews and they're talking to the real people involved in either working on the case, people, victims in the case, people who knew the offender and intimately, not just, right, oh, well, I worked with him for like 3 months, 20 years ago. A lot of it is really like the loved ones, and the point of Evil Lives Here is like it's about living in the same home as somebody. Yeah. So whether that evil took place in the home or not, I find a lot of the interviews that people actually sit for to be really valuable, and oftentimes I don't see them interviewed anywhere else.
Yeah, that was a big one for this. So his daughter Pam sat for this interview. Her brother, Michael, has stayed almost entirely out of the public eye. I looked. I couldn't find anything from him. Mm-hmm. His wife hasn't really said anything. And for her, her interview was saying, yeah, I had no idea this was going on until we knew all of it. Mm-hmm. And that was so terrifying and so awful.
Yeah.
So as much as that is helpful and that can help me give you a look into what their life is like, maybe some of his motives, some of the man behind the crime, if you will. Mm-hmm. It didn't give me names and dates. And because it was in the 80s, I don't have, you know, a super clear cut picture of a lot of things. What I'll give you today is what I can confirm that we have connected and that I have verified by looking up. But other than that, I mean, I'm sure there's more that we don't have in here today.
I also think that when we say things are like from a long time ago, like the 80s, I don't mean like that's forever ago. It's just that we don't mean that. A lot of you listening were alive for the 80s, and I'm very jealous.
I want a perm so bad.
I was not, but the music was elite. But we usually bring that up to say that the internet was not a thing. It wasn't even what it is today in the 90s and early 2000s. So for us to get like the most crystal clear picture of something that happens, it needs to be so widely researched and talked about, mm-hmm, and recorded and then also then submitted up in the internet, which rarely that happens. So we are really like searching and really trying to get to the bottom of it. So we apologize if we ever get some of like the minor details wrong. It's just what we could find and it was the most reputable that we thought.
And we always try, but on top of that, you always have access to all of our sources. So anytime you hear us talk about anything, there's going to be a link or a description of how we got that information. Because look, if they're wrong, I don't want to be why you think it's wrong. Like, I'm telling you what I thought a reputable source said. So you can have all of my reputable sources anytime you want.
We do. We always have them linked below, but no, we don't think the 80s are like 100 years ago. And no, in my mind, it's still 20 years ago. But thinking of like availability of information, I mean, what we have available now and what was available then are entirely black and white different.
Well, and we'll get to it, I think, actually, in the next episode on this, is just how much investigations, I guess, have been propelled forward by the internet and by that sort of instantaneous, like, online banking, stuff like that. So we'll get there. But all of that to say, there are a few sources. There's as many as I could find that I found reputable, and they seemed like a little bit of either a newer podcast or just one I hadn't heard of before that I really liked. So big shout out to Northern Nightmares. And for some trigger warnings, I also wanted to mention that, of course, we're talking about violence and homicide. Next episode, there will be some mentions of potential sexual assault, but I want to emphasize, due to the lack of information we have on a lot of the intimate details on some of these killings, none of this gets really graphic, but it is mentioned.
Okay.
Just so you know. Okay. So with all that good out of the way, I wanted to start today by asking you if I've ever forced you to listen extensively to my trip to Alaska yet. Yes, but you loved it so much you want to hear it again? Ah, okay, I got you. So my old roommate, Emily, and good friend of the pod, we went in 2021. It was beautiful. We saw Native Alaskan culture, stumbled upon a fun pop-up art fair in Anchorage, drove in the world's most terrifying one-lane tunnel that you share with oncoming traffic and a train, saw orcas and wild moose and the Northern Lights. And they say that Alaska is the last frontier, and to be honest, it really still is. I love Alaska. I love that in the summer, it's light so long they can't do fireworks on the 4th of July because it just doesn't get dark enough. I love that there are days full of darkness in the winter. I find locations that are geographically difficult to survive in really fascinating. Like, they normally have a richer culture or more innovative history than other people's. But it's also so big and wild and fierce. And where Emily and I went wasn't that crazy. I mean, we were mostly in Anchorage, which is like a city. It's a pretty big city in Alaska. But even we saw wild moose. A man who hosted us, like the hosting couple for where we stayed, he ate a flower right in front of our faces. And I loved it. And I miss him every day. He said, "Do you want one? They're delicious." And then ate it.
Well.
And I said, "You know what? Yeah." And it tasted like cabbage. So, ew. But I bring this up to say that there's other pieces of Alaskan culture. Yes, there is everything I just said. Like, the nature is wonderful. I love the wildlife piece of it. But there's also stereotypes of anywhere that's sort of in the backwoods, whether that's Alaska or like Maine or I'm sure the middle of Wyoming, you know? But stereotypically, the men like hunting. And someone has to stay home to care for the home, so sometimes that's the women, but not everyone can take for granted electricity or running water, normal grocery stores on every corner, or even neighbors in earshot. And while there are so many people who love these places like I do, for the nature and the wildlife, there are also other people who like the solidarity to escape into the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And today, we're talking about someone who goes to Alaska to escape into the unknown. We're not going to get there until next episode, but I want you to have in the back of your mind that everywhere they lived, there's an element of this.
Yeah, and I think that some people go to Alaska because they want to live among the nature and it's beautiful, and of course, look at it.
Yeah.
But then there's also people that go there to run away because they want to be alone, because they don't want to be found, because it is incredibly difficult to find somebody.
Yeah. Alaska, and part of what fascinates me about it is sort of this notion that, like, it is developed, but it is still very much a frontier. Sometimes you have to go so far north to go south. Or, like, when Emily and I went to Alaska and went through that terrifying tunnel, if you didn't make it in time to go through the very specific tunnel schedule, it takes you 10 hours to get around the mountain when that drive otherwise takes an hour. So
that is some weird roadway shit.
It's crazy. I mean, we didn't have a rental car for the first like 2 days, but even in the quote unquote city, trying to like find groceries to DoorDash was a challenge.
Yeah.
So it's beautiful, but it is truly like you are living on that land. You are living with that land. You are not just living off the land. You're living off of whatever that specific piece has to offer you at that time.
It's quite desolate.
It is. And that is beautiful and wonderful for anybody else who has a little cottagecore daydream. But it's also wonderful for anybody who wants to get the fuck off the grid.
Right.
So with all of that in mind, I want us to just take a little mental image of what a stereotypical dad from the woods is like. All right. Is he a little bit gruff? He likes guns, doesn't he? He probably has a pretty callous personality, but his hands are definitely more calloused than that. Maybe he likes hunting or has like a deer or a moose head on his wall or like the bear skin thing hanging up or like a rug. I don't know.
Maybe he loves to grill.
He'd love a grill. But you know what else? He probably really likes classic rock and swears it's the only kind of music worth listening to.
Mm-hmm.
Or country. It could be both, but you know, that's the vibe. How about the Budweiser in his hand? Because Bud Light is for pansies. Okay. He probably gives a really good hug, but he probably doesn't give that hug very often.
So when you do get that hug, it means something.
It's special. And it's a good hug.
Yeah, they usually have like a softer center, but the gruff might be a like little gruffy on the outside, mm-hmm. little like tough and intimidating, but then you're like, oh, he's just a big teddy bear.
Yeah. So in so many ways, that is the kind of guy we're about to talk about today.
Just with a minor flaw.
Just
happens to kill people.
Yeah, just with a taste for murder.
Oh, God.
Or more realistically, a lack of morals and a taste for not working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, don't love that. See, that doesn't sound like the backwoods guy to me.
No, because most backwoods guys I know have such a good work ethic.
And I don't mean backwoods like bad or wrong, but I just mean like that, like you like to live in a rural area.
Yeah, country guys.
Yeah, like you take care of your own stuff.
And I honestly, I think that people who live in the country and live a lifestyle like this, not like Charles Sinclair's, but like a very rural lifestyle, are truly some of the hardest workers I know. And often sometimes the best people that you come across, because they really work for everything they have. They take nothing for granted, and it's all for the sake of their family and their home.
And they have a respect for everything around them.
So it's just kind of a mind fuck to get something so close to that and yet so fucking far away.
Yeah.
In Charles. But today we're talking about his time as the coin shop killer.
Not his best era.
No, not my favorite era. Actually, most of his life is not my favorite era. But Charles Sinclair was born the youngest of four kids in New Mexico, 1946.
Okay.
So we don't start in Alaska. We will get there. But by all accounts, he seemed to have a pretty normal childhood. And if he didn't, no reports of abuse or neglect made their way to schools or the government to count on. It wasn't in any interviews that somebody said out loud. So it seems like it was a really pretty normal childhood, barring one particular issue. Charles' dad died while he was really young.
Mm.
And that's really hard for anybody. That, of course, does not mean somebody's going to turn out to become homicidal. But from anything I can see, this is the only obscurity in how he grew up. And even that seemed pretty good. His mom, who would have been a single mother of four in the 1950s, created a laundry business to find a way to keep her family afloat. Which, it doesn't sound like it was really glamorous, but for a woman to have a successful enough business to live and support four kids in the 1950s on her own is a pretty big success.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. Good for her.
Right?
That's pretty resilient.
And again, like on her own, a single mom, she was doing all of this grieving her husband with four kids that were grieving their dad.
Mm-hmm.
So while I'm sure that there were things that slipped through the cracks, she really rose to that fucking challenge. And I think that that's worth talking about because it's, I don't know, it's a win. And I want to make sure that we know that like, the hardest part of his childhood was still hard, but it sounded like he had a family that really worked together to try to overcome it.
Mm-hmm.
Early on in his childhood, Charles developed an interest in coins.
Like me.
Yes. I think a lot of kids go through a phase like this, or there wouldn't be like a billion fucking press-a-pennies at every tourist spot you go to.
They hate to see me coming.
They're quaking. You're getting every design, babe. I know it.
I'm going to give you $3 worth of coins to get a useless penny.
And it's going to be so cool.
And it's going to sit in my wallet for a couple of years until I put it somewhere else and forget where I put it.
Hell yeah. Well, Charles probably would have related to that, except he had a bit of a deeper fascination. I don't think he ever forgot where he put them.
Mm.
And he also never really grew out of it. This is something that he was interested in all the way through adulthood. And it grew and developed so much that actually when he was old enough, he opened up a rare coin shop in New Mexico where he would buy and sell rare coins, gold coins, and silver coins. But this shop became so successful, he was actually able to expand it and branch out to start selling rare and high-end firearms, calling his shop Shooter's Supply.
Okay, so I don't want to give him business knowing what I know. Mm-hmm. However, to walk around in there, I love old coins.
Yes.
Specifically old ones. I don't really care that they have value, but just the fact that all the different people who utilize them, all the different hands that change, I just find it fascinating. I have like an entire little box of like old coins that I don't think are valuable, but they're just cool.
Yeah.
And I'm just a weirdo like that. So I can appreciate that and I'd want to walk around, but I wouldn't buy a goddamn thing.
Yeah, take that.
Because I'm mad at him.
We should be. And it would be interesting to walk around and see. And I don't know what a rare firearm looks like, but hell, I'd see it once, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Why not? And this was all in New Mexico where he was born and raised. And while he was running this shop, Charles met a woman named Debbie and they fell in love and they married and immediately started a family.
Charles and Debbie.
Yeah. So they started to make a family and the couple had two kids, Pam and Michael. We don't know how old Michael is. We know he's younger than Pam, but relatively close in age. And we know that Pam was born in 1974.
Okay.
So there wasn't like a big age gap, but we don't have specifics there. In the community, Charles was well known. He was friendly and charming and he would talk to anybody, really. He had a boisterous personality, and even though he wasn't super warm and fuzzy, he was very charming, and he liked to talk to people. I've heard that he could be even a little extra friendlier if he knew he could get something from you.
Okay, yeah, I don't like him.
It's giving used car salesman vibes. That's what Northern Nightmare said. Although, I will say, like, it doesn't give me he'll sell me a stolen Ford. It gives me like, he'll sell me a used car and happen to forget that the entire suspension and alternator went bad last month.
It seems like he'd sell you the car that he's like, pioneers used to ride these babies for miles, but you can see the ground through the floor.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like it's rotted out, but he's like, but it's got a good frame. It's got
it. He said it's a 1999 Toyota Corolla. Do you guys know what I'm talking about? Please tell me you do.
If you don't, look it up and then look up Craigslist posting.
Yeah, it's like Craigslist or Facebook, and it is the most hysterical posting for a car I've ever seen, and perhaps the actual most transparent marketing I've ever seen for a Corolla.
If somebody ever made a meme museum, that car would be in there. And if it hasn't already been made or drafted,
dibs.
Trademark.
Yeah. ATFTC is Meme Museum. Thank you. But so the years go by, and around 1985, the shop starts struggling.
Mm.
So where the rare coins and firearms used to be, I don't know, maybe something a lot of people like to go walk around and look at, maybe that starts to decline.
Mm.
And they're still in New Mexico, but Shooter Supply is not doing well, and the family starts to take on debt because of that. They start amassing a bunch of debt, and it had been a really tough year. And they seemed to also live outside of their means a little bit, which, like, who among us hasn't made the issue where you have to self-correct? But it doesn't seem like they ever self-corrected which couldn't help on top of having one income with four people to feed, and two of those were school-aged kids.
Yeah, who were constantly growing out of their clothes, who need school supplies.
Who eat everything in the pantry. I don't know if you've ever been with a boy going through puberty. Like, that's insane. I think we went through like 3 gallons of milk a week. That's nuts.
That's a lot. It's good for your bones, though.
That's what they say, you know. But that summer in 1985, the shop suddenly burned to the ground.
Oh.
And that's not good, of course. Charles actually had to go to the hospital for smoke inhalation. And when he was questioned about the fire to see if it was arson, he told the investigators that it wasn't arson, but it was his fault. See, he had spilled some chemical like the day before, the night before, and he went in early that morning to try to clean it up. But see, when he plugged in the vacuum or carpet cleaner, it created a spark and then the whole place lit up. He tried really hard to put it out. He did. But once he realized that there was no stopping it, he got out of there and called the fire department as fast as he could.
I wonder if anything was actually left there that was of value.
That would be interesting. Mm. It did burn. As far as I know, it seemed like it truly burnt to the ground.
Yeah, but if you just burn the place you're renting versus all of the valuables that you have inside, I don't know. I just saying I don't trust him.
Yeah, that's so good. Listen to your gut, babe.
Yeah, my gut tells me.
Listen to your heart.
I don't like him.
Yeah. Well, investigators could at least confirm that the place did light right up, pretty much burn entirely to the ground. But because of that, there was no evidence. And due to the lack of evidence, the investigation had to come back inconclusive. But everyone believed him. They felt bad for him. And even Debbie was like expressing a lot of anxiety because the shop is their only income. Now that's burned down. Her husband, who she loves, is in the hospital. Hmm. And oh, now they have hospital bills on top of the debt they were amassing, on top of the fact that they no longer have the one income they did have.
Oh, that's so sad.
So that's stressful. And maybe Debbie, too, was a tummy ache survivor. I don't know. But I would have one. I know that. In the episode of Evil Lives Here that I watched, Pam says that she thinks this is when his criminal career really began. Because Charles did reassure Debbie that it would be fine, but he knew it would be fine. Allegedly.
Hmm.
See, he knew they had a lot of insurance money coming their way. And that should be more than enough. Now, whether that happened and they just ran off with it and didn't pay any of their bills, or if it didn't come through, or if they just didn't wait around long enough to find out if it would, I'm not really sure, because over the next few weeks, instead of paying off their debt like Charles seemed to convince Debbie they could, the couple just defaulted on all of their bank loans. Instead of filing for bankruptcy, they decided they were just going to flee to Montana and start over.
So that's quite a move.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, hey, but doesn't credit kind of follow you even if you move? Isn't that tied to your name and like your SSN and all that?
It's kind of what I was anticipating.
Mm-hmm. Well, that only happens if you keep the same identity, silly.
Oh, okay. So they just ran.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So in 1985, the Sinclair family moves to Montana and they changed their name from Sinclair to Weir.
Okay.
Which, fun fact, was apparently the last name of one of Charles' old high school classmates.
What a weird thing to be that guy.
It's so funny to me. Like, I like that one.
I like that name.
That's ours now.
I don't know how I would take that if someone was like, I'm gonna have your name.
I'd be like, I mean, thank you, but like, ask me first.
And then he also kind of made it infamous.
Ask me first?
Rude. You know? That's just rude. That's just bad manners.
I would say that it might be kind of easy to couch them. It's the 80s. It's not like 1920s where you can just say you're whoever anywhere you are, you know? Except that Charles had, I don't know if he bought the stuff or if he previously had the equipment, but he had everything he needed to make the entire family new fake IDs. So he got one, Debbie got one, Pam and Michael both got one, and so they were no longer the Sinclairs, they were the Weirs.
How confusing for the kids to be like, you know your name.
Yep.
It's not anymore.
Well, and he did it in such a way that I don't think, like, there have been no reports of abuse to the kids.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it sounds like when he was home, he liked being a dad. But it sounds like he almost used this as a fear tactic, like, oh, the police want to frame us for this. Mm-hmm. So we have to change our name because they're bad. And if they find out that we're Sinclairs and not the Weirs, then it's going to be because of you that they split up our family. And I love you and I don't want to leave you.
And they love their dad. And so they're like, if this gets out, he has to leave.
Mm-hmm. So then it's like a protective thing. It's not like I'm afraid of him. I'm afraid of losing him.
So does it make sense to say that a lot of this for this first episode is really almost kind of what the kids would have picked up on at this time? Like noticing, like, hey, we know that dad's business burned down and we know we had to move. But like, they don't know the reasons for it. They don't know right. the background of all of this. Like, I mean, I don't think the wife does either. It sounds like she's just as blindsided as they are.
Well,
but like all of this, the details of everything, it sounds like that comes out a lot later.
Yes. So all of the details that we talk about come out later. But it's interesting because this is technically when most people believe his criminal career starts.
Okay.
And we'll talk about it next episode more. But with the sheer amount of crime that we see and just sort of the callousness of it, I really don't think this could have been the start of it. I think there had to be stuff going on in the background, which probably made some of these things happen.
Mm.
Personally, if my shop burned down, whether or not it was my fault, and the investigation came back inconclusive, I don't think I personally would feel a reason to run and change my entire name and my entire family's.
No.
So people like to say that they think that's the beginning of this. I tend to believe that there's got to be more going on under the scenes that we don't know that hasn't been reported.
Like, it's the beginning, but it's not the first.
Yes, it's certainly the beginning of what people are noticing and what they're seeing. And that's really all I can say because, you know, getting newspaper clippings from the 80s was not actually crazy easy.
No, I didn't think it would be.
But the thing is, once they got to Montana, neither Charles nor Debbie really seemed to make an effort to work. And this really deviates from the norm because Charles, yeah, he might give you kind of like used car salesman vibe, but he had a work ethic. He built a shop and he ran that shop and people liked him. They thought he was a stand-up guy. And not that you have to own a business or work that hard to be a stand-up guy, but this seems like where both of them really just stop working. Hmm. Elsewhere. Debbie, it doesn't sound like she really had much of a job back in New Mexico other than being a stay-at-home mom, which is in and of itself a job, but like not outside of the home. So that's not really new. She was just really leaning into like being the best stay-at-home mom you'd ever seen. You know,
I imagine that they're in Montana and she like gets up early and she's like making breakfast for the kids and like, oh, I'll get something ready for him for work. And then like, he comes down an hour later and he's still in his pajamas and she's like, where aren't you gonna,
mm-hmm.
like, how are we gonna afford this? What are we doing? Like, she's running the home.
Yep.
But there's gotta be money coming in to run the home.
Yeah.
Because she's gonna do a damn good job.
But that means grocery shopping. That means making sure that the kids have school supplies and clothes that fit them, that they're not growing out of every 3 months, which they do, you know?
Right.
So it does seem a little bit odd. But Charles does find or start, it's unclear, a mysterious new business.
Mm-hmm.
See, every few months, he has to leave for a couple weeks, you know, 2-3 max. But then he brings back enough money for, you know, the rest of the time. So he really only has to leave like a couple times a year.
Okay, are they hiring though?
I don't think you want to work for this HR department.
Okay.
I'll be real. Family is curious. Pam, Michael, Debbie, they're all not entirely sure what's happening, but whether they don't ask a lot of questions or he's just a man of few words, I'm not sure. But they don't get a lot of solid answers.
Could be both.
Could be both.
You don't question him.
Yep. And if you do, you're going to get only what he wants to tell you anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing that each member of the family seemed to think was that now, instead of having a coin business with a physical shop, that Charles was doing this just sort of freelance. Like, it wasn't out of a building. There wasn't a place he was keeping this collection. He just sort of had it and maybe would go sell or buy from people on these trips.
I could see that working, especially if part of the reason they were struggling financially before was maybe like owning the building or owning the shop mm-hmm. that they had, or that rent or leasing the space was so expensive that if he can have the valuables that he needs and then maybe attend like fairs or rent space in somebody else's place rather than like having all of your own, I could see that being financially responsible.
And so the reason that they seem to think this is because at least Pam recounts multiple times sort of like seeing him sitting out at the table with his coins out, whether that's the rare coins or gold or silver. He would like inspect them. He'd have the little rubbing alcohol bins out so he could clean them. And then he would go on these business trips for a few weeks, a few times a year, and then he'd be home the rest of the time.
Right.
And this time in their life is weird. So remember, Pam was born in like 1974. The shop burned down in 1985. She's like 11, 12, like middle school age mm-hmm. at this point. And just like you said, it's weird when your last name suddenly gets ripped away from you and you don't know why, other than it's to keep your family together. But suddenly things in their family home with like their last name or an S or clothing that had Sinclair just started sort of going missing and never showing up again.
Mm.
And at one point, Pam recounts sort of having friends over at this house in Montana, and she had this old, like, she said it was soccer or basketball, but like an older jersey with her old last name on it. And she remembers getting in big trouble. Like, Charles like made her come in from the porch, take it off, make up a whole story about how it was like laundry day. And then basically was like, you cannot do this. Like, you have to be better about this.
Which is like weird and scary for a kid. But then it also creates this like us versus them mentality mm-hmm. where she's like hyper loyal to the family.
Yeah.
To a fault. Because she's also getting paranoid.
She's getting paranoid and she's growing up. Like, she doesn't even have the frontal lobe to debate this in her own head anyway. This person that is supposed to have her best interest at hand and should be telling her the truth is telling her that this is what's keeping their family together and she can't mess it up.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of pressure for a kid, and it's confusing.
And I also give her credit. They moved to Montana and she's already like made friends and I know, having and people like, over and
talking on the little porch.
And she just had to like up and leave her old life not knowing why. I imagine it's so hard to like plant roots when you had to be ripped away from them.
Right. And like, all of this is weird, but the rest of their life is pretty normal. You know, the kids go to school, they get to have friends, they don't want for a whole lot. It sounds like they did extracurriculars at mm-hmm. least.
Yeah.
They were able to just have a pretty normal home life. Mom and dad were home. We had dinner at the table, everybody together. Like, normal things, except that neither of them really worked, and now they had a new identity. And it's somewhere around this time that Pam says she got curious. So she asked her parents at dinner one day. She was like, you know, why don't you guys have to work? Like, all of my friends, their parents have to work, but like, we can afford to live. You guys don't have to do that. Like, why? And I don't think it was judgmental. I don't think it was anything bad. I think she just was freaking curious. She's a kid.
Well, that also makes sense, especially because she grew up in a home where dad was working. And now all of a sudden you don't have to like put in hours and time and effort and we can still have all the things we had. Like, why is everyone else stupid? Why are they working?
Exactly. And Charles said that if anybody ever asked, they had to say it's because he worked in oil, they were really good with money, and so they were able to retire early.
See, now telling her you have to say this versus the truth is this is what it is and I worked in oil.
Also, like, she's 11 or 12. I don't know. She's in middle school. She's not dumb. She knows he didn't work in oil. She was like, okay, unless rare coins is now what they're calling oil. Like, you can call it PlayStation 4 to me. Like, it's the same thing. I know you're not doing this.
Right.
So she was just like, I don't know why we have to lie, but fine. Like, if anybody asks, that's what I'll say.
Kind of thing. Sure, you work in oil.
And the thing is, Charles had found a way to make money, and it wasn't in oil, womp womp, and it wasn't in reselling his coins. Instead of working or continuing his business, Charles would find little rare coin and jewelry shops throughout the United States. And then he would stake them out for a few days, come different days at different times, build rapport with the employees, figure out when it was least busy. And right after he tells them a lie that he would either buy or sell several $1,000s worth of a collection, he would then come at the least busy time, shoot the employee in the head, rob the store blind, and take everything they could offer.
Oh my God.
He'd then fly home to his family, fund their life for the next few months off of this loss, and it never seemed to faze him.
So this was purely transactional.
So transactional.
He just goes in, he knows the business, so he can kind of tell if what they've got is of value or not.
Mm-hmm.
And then murder somebody in cold blood because they stand between him and the cash register.
Yeah.
How callous.
So callous. And it's so, this one is so surprising to me that I've never heard, because we're going to talk about it. He's connected to over 10. That's a lot.
That's a lot of murders.
And that's just what he was able to be connected to. And this was in the 80s. So it's likely that there are some more that just didn't get the coverage or the attention that they deserved.
Or that, yeah, they just didn't get connected to him. So he's never like, yep, I did that one, that one, and that one. It's whatever they could pin to him.
Right. And I'll give you a little spoiler alert. He does die before he confirms anything that he did. So everything that we're talking about today, I am just throwing in that, like, it's connected. It is alleged. And there is good, solid evidence to say it's connected. But I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I have more than I have,
mm-hmm.
you know? So the first murder that he's suspected of is Thomas Rohr. And this is August 28th of 1985. And the year might ring a bell because it's the year that they moved to Montana. So we don't know if in this month they were in New Mexico or Montana. This family moved around from like neighborhood to neighborhood a lot.
Hmm.
So it's kind of hard for them to remember like which specific month they moved out of state, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, there's no way to connect it and they just don't remember. So if they were in New Mexico, maybe this is what led them to flee, but I'm not entirely sure because this shop was in Mishawaka, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And it was shortly after the burning of Shooter's Supply that he went out to Indiana. But Charles was out. He did his whole scheme. He stayed there for a week or two. He sussed it out. And then he met the manager of this coin shop. His name was Thomas Rohr. And all we know was that Charles was there. And then Thomas was dead and the shop was robbed.
So at this time, he's either living in New Mexico or in Montana.
Mm-hmm.
But then he travels from either one of those places to Indiana to commit this murdered burglary.
Yes.
And then returns home, wherever home was at this time.
Yep.
So he does not move to Montana and start robbing Montana places and then...
No, and this is a trend we'll see everywhere except for, and it's so funny to say this, every other crime that he commits is very thought out like this. It is not in a bordering state, as far as we know. It's very like to the point, I'm watching, this is for a purpose, it's a means to an end, I don't care, I'm doing it, and then I'm leaving.
He's not a local, he won't be recognized, he doesn't live there.
Right. And he goes far enough away that you're probably not going to see it in the state over. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's curious because it does make headlines like the day it happens, but then it just doesn't stay in the news. It's the 80s. We don't have a 24-hour news cycle like we do now, just constantly spewing shit at you all the time, always.
Constantly.
From hell. It's great.
It never ends.
Woohoo.
Okay.
But they didn't have this. And this is truly one of the cons of that. Like, the things that deserve to hit the news don't stay in it super long. And it was a pretty small town. So everybody really just thought it was like a tragedy of a robbery gone wrong. And unless it was like the town it was in, it never really came up twice.
Mm.
The police didn't even really think they'd find who did it when they saw it. And then it went cold quicker than that. After Montana, they lived there for a few months. The Weir Sinclair family moved to Washington State just a little bit later. It's posed to the kids as an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, we lived in New Mexico, but we had to move to Montana. And we just don't like it that much, right? So we're going to move again. We're going to go to Washington. And anywhere we go, we'll drive all around the state. Wherever we like the best, that's where we'll stay.
So they're making it a game.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe to win their kids over.
I think probably. I mean,
they need buy-in from the kids.
I can't imagine being a kid in that age group moving that many times.
Nope.
You can't find any long-term friendships. You can't really like foster any significant healthy relationships beyond the one with your mom and your brother and your dad when he's not gone for a few weeks at a time.
Right.
So here's the thing, though. They do go to Washington. They sit there. And if I remember right, and when I say remember right, I mean, if the sources that I've heard this from are true, they moved a couple of towns a couple of times in Washington. So even there, they weren't really settled.
Mm-hmm.
But when the money gets low, Charles magically has another business trip.
Mm.
Isn't that so cool? And this one is the one outlier that we know about. And I want to emphasize this because I know it's the second one that I'm telling you about, but you'll see shortly, none of the other crimes that he commits, none of the other murders that he is behind, or anything like this that we know about. So with that in mind, Charles decides he doesn't want to go that far. He's going to stay local this time. And he strays from his usual. And again, we are 99.9% sure it is him. I will tell you so much about that, and you will be certainly on the same page as I am next episode. But I want to take a minute here to tell you about Robert and Dagmar Linton.
Hmm.
Because Robert and Dagmar Linton are the people that we all want to be.
Oh.
Or at least I do. Okay. They're a retired married couple who had been together for 41 years. They were high school sweethearts and made a family, and they had just retired. They were super close with their kids and everybody in their family. And Dagmar was like type A.
Hmm.
So she had this whole thing plotted out. They were going to do like sort of a car camping situation. It wasn't really an RV, but it sounded like an attachable camper to their truck.
Okay.
That they were going to drive up the West Coast in, and they lived in California, and they were going to go for a while up the coast all the way to Vancouver, Canada. And so they had like, as you can imagine with a very type A traveler, very strict stopping points. They had everywhere they were going to be plotted out on a map ahead of time with an itinerary, with what campsite they'd be at. They were going to call their kids on every, you know, Xth day, maybe 3 days. Anytime they got to a new place, tell them about their adventures. While they were in this place, they're going to go see this thing. They wanted to check out this trail.
That is so wholesome and awesome. I want to do that.
And like, again, this had to be planned. It's the 80s. So it's not like pull out your phone, like your cell phone and text or call. It's like we have to be at a place where there's cell service and also probably a phone booth.
Yeah.
And like all of this really took extra planning because there's none of that spur of the moment in your pocket, look up a place to stay for the night kind of thing.
Yeah.
As you can imagine, for a woman like Dagmar, the kids had a copy of the itinerary. So they knew what was happening.
Love her.
Me too. She's so cute. And I just love that they liked each other enough that they were like, we're retiring. We're celebrating. Let's go have an adventure. We're still going to like still be our people, still be with our people as much as we can, talk to them. But like, we're doing this for us. And it's been 41 years. I'm like, that's what I want. You know,
and you're headed into your rocking chair years and you've retired and you've got the time now that you never did. And you actually said you were going to do it and then you went and did it.
Yes.
You know, we have all these plans. I think people love to talk about. Hell, I have plans and I am nowhere near retirement. I hope I get there. But like, of all the things you want to do when the kids are grown,
yeah,
you know, maybe there's grandkids and you just want to like travel and visit and do all the things that you want to do because you can now.
Yeah.
How awesome that they actually did it.
Yeah. And that's where this gets hard.
Oh, I forgot. This is a true crime podcast and I'm going to cry.
You are probably going to cry. It's not great. They pull into Brennan, Washington in August of 1986. This is going to be their little campgrounds for the next few days. And so they come in, they meet their little campground neighbors. Mm. You know, they hang out. It was like a group of guys that were really friendly. And they decided to like, you know, we got your back, you get ours. If we see anything weird, hear anything weird, like we'll just keep an eye out for each other. Which is perfect. Amazing. Love that. Doesn't have to be anything more than that. Mm-hmm. I hope you guys have a great campfire. We're going to go cozy up and read our little books.
Yeah.
You know? So the next day, or, you know, one of the days shortly after, the Lintons head out and they have the misfortune of running into Charles. I wish I could tell you more, but what I can tell you is that he was either going by Larry Ulrich or Charles or J.C. Weir, but they're all Charles and Claire. He is all them. And we don't know what happened to Dagmar and Robert Linton. Their bodies have never been found.
Oh.
But what we do know is that sometime shortly after they came into this campsite, Charles started using their credit card.
Oh, no.
The campground neighbors raise alarm 2 days later. I love this, first of all. They say, yikes, the camper's at the campsite, but they have their truck. So, like, they're not back. And one night, I guess maybe they could have stayed in a motel or a hotel and decided they didn't want to come all the way back. But two nights feels weird. And they immediately tell the campground, like, hostess, administrator kind mm-hmm. of thing. And they look at it and they say, yeah, that's fucking weird.
Also good on the neighbors, because I feel like, especially today, nobody would fucking notice if people didn't come back because right. they're so wrapped up. They're on their phones.
Also,
nobody really wants to socialize. Nobody, like, you'd almost feel like you might feel like you're intruding on somebody by like noticing or even like kind of checking around and looking. Like, there's a bunch of different reasons why I think that could happen. But I feel like today we are less social than we yes. would have been. And that exchange of like, hey, neighbor, wouldn't have happened. And then maybe they wouldn't have noticed the days gone by where nobody has touched anything at their campsite and their truck is not there.
Right. Well, and it's so good that they raised this alarm, but it's also so amazing because not only did the neighbors, but the campground administrator immediately called the police. They took it seriously. And then the police took it seriously. And I just love to see everybody sort of hop on board as fast as reasonably possible mm-hmm. and not let it go as like a, oh, well, they're just adventuring, or, oh, well, like, this doesn't matter because.
Right.
So the sheriff comes to the campground on August 22nd of 1986. They find the empty camper and they want to keep a close eye on the credit card, which they've found out is still being used.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to make a note here that I learned so much about credit card usage in the 1980s for this research. I didn't know that they used to have to like take an imprint of the card with the carbon copy of a receipt. And then shops would keep all of those receipts until the end of the month, where they then submitted it to the credit card company for payment. And then the credit card company would either like reach out or bill the person to then pay from their bank. So it was not like today where there's like, oh, you swipe it and there's an immediate pending charge on there.
Right.
It took weeks to even get like quote unquote charged to the credit card.
It's completely unrelated, but when I used to work retail in college,
mm-hmm.
I think I'm a relatively smart person. I did not know what to do when someone handed me a check.
Oh, yeah.
Because I had never needed to enter one. Like, it was so weird to see somebody, like, I remember going to the grocery store with my mom when I was a kid, and she had her checkbook, and it yeah. had, like, you know, whatever design you picked that it had on it, and, like, the outside of the book had, like, a cute little case, and, like, people lived out of their checkbooks, you know yeah. what I mean? Like, you'd always see, like, the moms in the line, like, getting it ready, just waiting to write in the total.
Right.
And somebody gave me that. And to me, it's like this similar thing where it's just like, oh, I wouldn't know what to do if someone gave me a card back then.
Right.
You know, you have to do it once to learn how to do it. And it took me like months before I ever actually had to do it. And I just thought it was so odd. But like, yeah, that thing gets submitted and do the whole thing. And how weird, right?
So strange. At least in terms of today's, you know,
instantaneous, commerce, but like, you know, cash doesn't count. If I spend it, it only matters if I see it leave my account immediately.
Right. And it's so, hey, I mean, good on ya. I need to take a lesson in like writing out my checkbook probably. But it makes stuff like investigating based off of credit card fraud so much more difficult because you don't have that trail immediately at your fingertips. So I think it's not only phenomenal that this case got flagged so fast for Robert and Dagmar, but that the investigators said, let's check this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that they were able to see that this card's still being used. And, you know, for some people, they might say, okay, cool. They just didn't come back for their camper.
Mm-hmm.
But let's take a look at some of the first things they purchased, because they purchased movie tickets. All right. Cool. Have a fun flick. Mm-hmm. Then they purchased a crock pot, which is like a little more weird.
You know, when I'm traveling, you ever just forget your crock pot on a trip and you go, fuck, I can't live without this. I need a new one.
Yeah. And that's why they sell them at the airport, you know?
Yeah. Because it fits so nice in your carry-on.
So nice. It's
so convenient.
Not clinky and loud or heavy at all.
No. And in fact, if it comes with a carrying case itself, it is your personal item.
Yes. And that is couture. But
so
I think what's more interesting here is like, I could find a use for a crock pot camping. Like, I love a good dump cake and like chili.
Yeah,
you know?
It's a dump and go. Cool. You come back at the end and look, dinner's ready. Amazing.
But I wouldn't really see a use for school supplies.
They bought school supplies.
They bought school supplies. And then a little bit later.
Whoever had the card.
Yeah, whoever had the card. Supplies. And then a clarinet. And then a pack of men's underwear.
That good old Fruit of the Loom six pack.
Tidy whiteys.
Mm-hmm.
I hate it when the band gets loose and then you have to get a new pack. And that's just life. That's literally just life. I'm sounding facetious, but that is just how it goes.
You hold on to them until they are ripping and you're like,
till there's nothing to hold on to no more.
You did great, soldier.
But again, this timeline is so delayed because of the way that all of these charges have to be submitted, because of the way that it's all working, that it's just taking a long time. And these purchases are relatively small and they're happening between Washington and Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that Charles has their credit card, but Charles goes to a coin shop in Oregon where he tries to buy some rare gold pesos. He wants to buy like three and he gets one. For like $500 fucking dollars.
For someone who puts in so much effort to go undetected, you then go to a coin shop?
To buy a $500 peso.
Buddy.
And then he tries to buy the other one or two that he was looking at, but he couldn't. Because the $500 had maxed out the card limit. I don't know how exactly you know that at the exact juncture. Like, I don't know. Because I never had to. But they did somehow. And instead of being a normal person who said, hey, I stole a credit card where I then bought a crock pot and a clarinet, which is not cheap. And now this $500 peso, maybe I maxed out the card. Charles said, it's probably just this fucking place.
Huh.
And in fact, he had maxed out the card, but the investigators were pretty good. And it seems like he was making these purchases far enough apart to like maybe make it look like it was active, but not raise
suspicion. Yeah.
That he didn't use it before the police were able to then see these transactions. So they call up the fucking credit card company and they're like, hey, man, can you please extend the credit limit on this? Let him keep buying things. We're so close to him. We just need to get him. We don't know who it is, but we know that it's someone.
And like, we think this is stolen. Please don't cancel. Like, don't let it decline. It'll tip him off. Just let it go.
And wonderfully, the credit card company is like, yeah, fucking for sure. Why not?
It's not real money anyway.
Yeah. Which I love. That's crazy to me, but I love it.
Mm.
And so now that they have all of this history, they're like asking the shops for descriptions, right? They're like, mm-hmm. who was this? What did they look like? And for most of them, they're like, I don't know, man. He bought like a 6-pack Fruit of the Loom Tidy Whiteys a month ago.
Right.
It could have been anyone.
You think I remember every 6-pack of underwear I sold?
This is not my first rodeo. But
you know what the average middle-aged man who buys a clarinet looks like? He looked like that. He looked like that, okay?
He sure did. And so they're not getting very far, but they were able to go to the place where Charles had bought the peso. And from that, they learned that he's about 6'4", which we know he's exactly 6'4". They probably heard he's over 6 feet. He's so tall.
Mm-hmm.
They also probably heard he's heavy set. He's like 260 pounds. He has a little bit of a beer belly. Hashtag dad bod. He's allowed. And then they found out that he had a gap in his teeth and oddly a very heavy Southern accent, which I didn't know this. I thought, well, yeah, of course, he's from the South. Apparently, New Mexico doesn't have a super strong Southern accent.
Yeah, I didn't think they would have.
So I don't know why he either put that on or what was going on, but it was notable.
I feel like if you're an outsider and you're trying to be undetected, you don't give yourself a quality that puts you out there, like right? An accent that you don't naturally have. Wouldn't you want to sound like the people around you so that you don't set off alarm bells?
You know, I would, but I also wouldn't be doing this. So maybe there's some mental differences there.
A few.
They also learned, interestingly enough, that Charles had a bandage on his right arm.
Mm-hmm.
And that might not be like a really big thing, but it was like from his forearm to like his hand.
Like he cut it?
Yeah. Like it could have gotten cut.
Okay.
Like maybe on the back of his arm or something. Mm. But the next month, the Oregon police find the Linton's truck.
Ooh.
And the Linton's truck was at an airport in Portland, Oregon. The interior was scrubbed entirely clean.
Okay, so they didn't do that.
No, they sure didn't, because they're camping.
Yep.
Yeah. But interestingly enough, on the bottom of the bed, so what I'm assuming is like, not when you look down at it, but like underneath the car, there was a really big rust-colored stain.
Mm.
And then in some horror film-like depiction, apparently, according to the Northern Nightmares podcast, they find out that it is not, in fact, rust, but it is blood. And it's a lot of blood. Like, from the amount of blood alone, they are convinced that the Lintons are dead.
I didn't know it was possible for blood to seep through the bed of a car. But I
didn't either.
Okay.
But the more you know.
That's very scary and concerning.
It's scary and concerning. And also remember, we're in the 80s. So there's no straight DNA testing.
No, you're going to get a type.
Yes. So they found 3 blood types in this mass of dried blood underneath this truck.
Okay.
And 2 of them, as you might suspect, exactly matched the Lintons.
Mm-hmm.
And 1 was a 3rd mystery type that they didn't know who it matched.
I will say, I do find it fascinating. If Charles had the same blood type as either one of them, would they have picked up on that? Or would they have just thought something, like they would have nothing to go off of on a 3rd person, I guess?
I guess it would probably have to match entirely. So like if one of them had A negative and he had A positive, that might be the only way for them to tell the difference.
Well, right. But those are 2 different blood types. So I'm saying if they're both, like, let's just say all 3 of them are A negative.
Yeah. How do you know?
Because you're not really able to determine, you know, DNA based on that. You're just getting types at this point. And then you save as much as you can so that you can try to test it when science evolves.
Right. Yeah. I have no idea.
But they didn't really have that yet. So in a way, they kind of lucked out in that all 3 of them had different types.
That's true. And honestly, the credit card and this are the 2 things that we know tie him to this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty important piece of evidence here that they have.
And we'll get to why, I'm guessing, in next episode.
Oh, yes, we will.
Okay.
Because reporters catch wind of this story, as they normally do. That's not shocking.
Mm-mm.
And police said, hey, we're so close. We are so close to finding this guy. We have descriptions. We have the card open that we're tracing. We have blood types now. Don't run this story. Let us find him first. Do not tip him off. But the reporters, unlike the credit card company, were not so helpful. And they said, no, fuck that. We're running the story.
We're going to make money.
And you know what? Immediately after the credit card purchases stop, and the Sinclairs, or the Weirs, immediately move out of Washington.
See, I hate that, though. I absolutely hate that, because this could have been stopped. How many other people's lives could have been saved? Now, I'm not blaming them, whatever, but it just, the series of events, had anything changed as it went? Like, if the police could get more of an upper hand on him, this could have ended here.
Right.
Let him spend it somewhere else. Bring him in for questioning. Where'd you get that cut? Da-da-da-da-da. Why are your prints? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Anything.
Are you in the business for a crock pot? I didn't know you played clarinet. Like, there's...
Well, and it's frustrating because obviously other places, like the credit card companies, see the merit and the worth in not doing this. They said, okay, maybe not our first choice to leave this open and extend the credit line on things we know we might not be getting back, but like, there's good reason.
But it's worth it.
Right, because humans are more valuable than any of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, very frustrating, but immediately tips him off. He's not dumb. You know, he goes to different states. He stops using a card the second it seems like they're onto him. He's done. He's out. And a few months later, in November of 1986, Charles hits again.
Mm-hmm.
So, this time it's a coin shop in Brackenville, California, so way down the coast,
okay,
called the Golden Hills Coin Exchange. I believe it was the owner of the shop, whose name was Reuben Williams. People called him Lucky.
So close to Robin Williams, but...
So close.
Okay. Just Lucky Williams.
A wee bit more Irish, yeah. But this was enough to fund the family for another 8 months or so. Whatever he got from this shop and Lucky did not survive. The shop was burglarized. There was nearly nothing of any worth left. And Charles was able to fund his family for another 8 months or so.
Wow.
And this happens for the next 4 years.
To just take from somebody in a day their life, their livelihood, and just for what? So that you don't have to go do the job that they were doing that you used to have. What?
And that is also something about this that is so confusing to me. It's like, this was your life. Like, you ran these shops.
That could have been you on the receiving end of this. And had you someone just else decided, done this.
Fuck it. Like, I don't think this just started when his shop burned down. And again, he does this for a few years. He goes on different business trips for a few weeks. And then every time he comes home with insane money and usually a different haircut.
So he's adjusting his appearance.
Oh, yeah. He'd like grow out a cool long beard and then he'd come back clean shaven. Or like maybe he'd grow like a mustache, or maybe he'd like dye it.
See, now if my husband were gone for a few weeks and he came back with like Justin Timberlake 90s frosted tips, where were you? What are you doing?
And I checked the credit card statement. You weren't in Vegas. So what's the real reason?
Yep. And since when do you play the fucking clarinet?
Literally. But the family, again, they're still moving frequently. And Pam and Michael didn't really get to create long relationships. They changed schools. They had to keep up with curriculums. And they're so preoccupied trying to exist as kids growing up that they probably didn't know that their family back in New Mexico considered them missing. People were looking for them.
Mm-hmm.
But Charles wouldn't let the kids like talk to or write to their grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he ever told them that they couldn't write to their grandparents, because Pam remembers writing multiple letters but never having any stamps. So being like, Dad, can you, you know, send this or mail it, or do you have a stamp? And he'd never had one on him, but he'd always say he'd mail them, and then they never got sent out, which just hurts my heart, because Pam would talk about how much it felt like, you know, you're just pouring your heart out to someone who doesn't even answer your letters.
Oh, and so she felt like her family, like she really did think that they were sent, and then she felt like her family was like rejecting her.
Yeah, she had no idea until later.
You know, and he stole years of everyone who loved them's life too from not having them around. Like,
yeah,
the grandparents missed out on spending time with their grandkids. I'm like, I want kids, no doubt, but I want grandkids.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, what is all this for? You know,
it's
but
for the damn grandbabies.
You know what I mean? Yeah. But like that time, that precious time, like if I could have more time with my grandparents, like I'd give anything to have a day.
Yeah.
And you just stole that from them because you'd rather kill people. I just
and it's
can't wrap my head around it.
Frustrating to me and confounding because I don't even think because that was his parents. I don't even think Debbie's parents knew where they were.
That's see, but that's still even worse. Like right, they didn't. Like, they just up and vanished.
And, you know, I know that the kids couldn't keep long-term relationships, but I feel the same thing for her, too. Like, she's not talking to her parents. She doesn't have any friends that they're lasting, you know? It's hard enough to keep up now with Snapchat in your fucking pocket, let alone when you had to write and call all the time and, like, schedule that in. And then the 90s happened and you dial up. That was a whole thing. But, like, they're all isolated together.
Now, do you think Debbie knew... Or are we going to say we don't? Like, I feel like maybe she thought something was up. I'm sure we'll talk about it,
well,
like, once everything comes out. But, like, right now, I feel like if I'm her, I'm suspicious. Like, you keep going places. We can somehow afford this. We keep moving. But if he's, like, this gruff guy, maybe he's intimidating. Maybe their relationship is such that she doesn't ask him questions.
It's hard because I don't know a lot about Debbie. All I know, and we will get to more of it later, but all I know right now is that Charles and Debbie both say she had no idea what was going on.
Okay.
Now, you can say whatever the fuck you want, but that's what they both say.
Mm.
So then in the next 2 years, Charles hits twice that we know of that we can connect him to.
Mm.
One is on July 14th, 1987. Charles hit a coin shop in Spokane, Washington, and murdered a man named Leo Cachet. He was the owner after closing.
Mm.
I would tell you more if I knew more. I don't have that information. On March 8th of 1988, Charles then also murdered Leroy Hoffman at his coin shop in Kansas City, Missouri.
So he's traveling.
He's going everywhere. He's been just in this half, Indiana, Washington, Oregon, Missouri, and probably Montana. So one day during this time period, Charles, Pam, and Michael were hanging out in the living room, and Charles asked a hypothetical.
Mm.
Much like the stereotype of the kind of dad I talked to you about at the beginning, I think you probably know a man like this who likes to debate for the sake of debating and ask you like what ifs just to hear your answers. Get your mind thinking.
People that make you think, have profound conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Challenge you.
Yes. And I love these kinds of people. Some of my favorite memories are being like, okay, but what if,
mm-hmm.
you know, with people that you know and trust, and it's like a safe, good environment to do that in, but you're exercising your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And he liked to do this with the kids all the time.
Yeah.
And so Pam and Michael are used to these like weird hypotheticals, like, I don't know, probably reading or doing a puzzle. And dad's like, hey, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Go, you know. But this day was different because Charles says, hey, do you guys think there's such a thing as a perfect crime?
Hmm.
And Pam goes like, what the my words, not hers, but like, what the fuck do you mean? You know? And he's like, you know, like you commit a crime and nobody knows about it. You never get found out. And Michael's like, yeah, Dad, like I'm sure there is. And Pam's answer was, well, you wouldn't know because if it's a perfect crime, nobody would know it happened.
Who's going to know?
Right. Who's going to tell him? Like, how can you know you got away with a crime or a crime was perfectly done if you didn't know it existed?
Mm-hmm.
Which sounds to me like they've been having a lot of these hypothetical conversations because that's some good logic. But she says normally like they kind of had a conversation about this stuff, right? Like it was kind of like a debate or like a back and forth, like a banter. And this time he just dissociated.
That's scary.
Charles just heard it and stared off for a notably long time. And Pam was like, yeah, I knew that was weird. I didn't know why it was weird, but I knew it was weird.
Yeah, she can reflect later and be like, okay, so this meant more than maybe I thought it did at the time.
Right. And so Pam says she thinks that this was to see if they knew what was going on or if they knew what he was up to.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't. She knew it was a weird question, but that's really all she thought about it.
Okay.
And then in the summer of 1989, out of the blue, middle of the school year, Charles comes home and says, "We're moving to Alaska."
Yay.
And that's where we're going to pick up next time.
No.
Yes. Next time we are going to get into more. Somehow there's more of his coin shop robberies and murders. Then we're going to catch up with the investigators, how Charles gets caught, and the aftermath.
All right. He gets caught. I can live with it.
Yes, he does.
But I hate him.
And you, yeah, he's gross. And I feel so bad for Pam and Michael. Debbie too. But like Michael has stayed entirely out of the news. I've tried to, you know, kind of respect that. As far as I know, Pam's really only done like the one interview on Evil Lives here. And she's just so clearly at odds with like, is he even who I thought he was ever?
Oh.
You know, like, is there ever a time in my history where who I thought my dad was actually who he was?
It just seems like his victim reach is so far.
Yeah.
Because you have all of the immediate murder victims. You have all of their loved ones. You have their colleagues who had to happen upon this and lose a coworker and then also probably need a new job suddenly, traumatically. And then you have his kids who have been victimized in other ways, and his wife.
Yeah.
And then you have their family members who didn't get to love on them. You know what I mean? Like, that lost years and years of very precious time.
Yeah. I mean, people were born and people died in their family, and the kids were just never notified of it.
And then you're also, like, isolated.
Mm-hmm.
And then you move to isolated places where, like, you don't have anyone as a sounding board.
Yeah.
Just, oh.
So, this is where we're at. I can't believe I'd never heard of him.
No, I've never heard of this case.
And it's heartbreaking, and it's so different than what we normally see in terms of like serial killers that have a lot of coverage and publicity. Like, this is not detailed, graphic, brutal, but it's brutal in the way that he just didn't give a shit.
Mm-hmm.
And that in and of itself is so mind-boggling that he could just do this over and over and over again for years for the sake of like, well, I just need money.
Well, there's also a kind of like equally scary part of like somebody who's rageful and angry and killing somebody versus somebody who can so easily like turn it on and off.
Mm-hmm.
To just be able to kill somebody transactionally, I think they're equally as dangerous. It's just that the buildup looks different.
So next time we will get to the survivor that he has.
Oh, which great. Is
so, actually, phenomenal story.
But there's one.
There is one.
You said survivor, not survivors.
There's a survivor. And we will hear about the investigation, the aftermath, and all of that. But if you did want to see what we're talking about, the people, the places, the things, you could do that on our Instagram. So you could find that below in our link tree. You could also send us pod pets, case recommendations, give us a little follow, a 5-star rating, a review if you wanted to.
We're biased. We think you should do 5 stars, but I'm just saying.
If you wanted to get the pod a little coffee or donate fiscally, we also got our Venmo and our PayPal in there, and of course our Redbubble if you want a little sticker or merch. You can even get retro ATFTC gear from our old logo and more is coming soon, so look out for that. But in the meantime, if I do look at my clock, that was
about time for true crime.
Bye.